time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Do you fill out one of these bracket things?
I have in the past. I didn't this year. I never do very well at them.
Yeah.
And I don't like to invest a lot of time and effort in things that I'm not very good at. So.
Are you a guy who roots for the chaos like Kentucky went down last night?
Yes. I love that kind of thing. Now, one year, the best year I ever did with the bracket was I picked the teams alphabetically.
Yeah.
And I think in the first round, I only lost two games.
Uh-huh.
And it actually worked out pretty well.
I have a friend who did the coin toss theory throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
I picked Illinois, I think, to go a long way just because of Andy Banker.
To the Final Four?
Close, yeah. Maybe to the Final Four. And then yesterday, after the first period, I got nervous, but they wound up pulling it back together. But I don't know. I found myself rooting for Kentucky to get beat.
Illinois's got defense issues. I don't think their defense is sufficient to, you know, suggest a deep run into this tournament. That's my assessment.
Wow, that sounds like a guy who maybe watched a game or two of them. Name just one player on Illinois' team.
Well, you got Smith out there, tremendous basketball player, and Johnson. Both of them are great. So Williams is not bad.
You're a contact wearer, right? But
you
do it goofy. Like you got one contact.
It's called monovision, Michael.
Yeah.
And the way it works is, and I'm saving myself all kinds of money on reading glasses. So you've got a dominant eye. Everybody's got a dominant eye.
Okay.
So one eye is going to be taken over more so than the other eye. Mm-hmm. So you first have to find out what your dominant eye is.
Yeah, I would think mine's the left because everything on the left is the best.
My dominant eye is the left eye. And so, and I'm nearsighted, which means I can't see in the distance.
They did.
And I'm really nearsighted. Like,
ditto.
You know.
Yeah.
You would not want me behind the wheel of a car.
No, we don't want you with full glasses behind the wheel of a car.
Well, I mean, that's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. So I wear the contact in my left eye, and I see the distance just fine, although I need a new one now, but that's another story. And in my right eye, naked.
Is that right?
Naked eye. And with the naked eye, my undominant eye, I can read the smallest print imaginable.
Do you have trouble touching your eye, like when you put the contact in and contact out? So I've been thinking about contacts, but a friend of mine told me that they just went to, they get daily contacts, so they're disposable. Seems like a lot of money, right, to make contacts that get thrown away every night?
Well, I mean, you know, you don't reuse. There's a lot of things you don't reuse out there.
Yeah.
Paper towels, toilet paper.
But just the whole concept of, like, touching my eye, I would like to do it. I hate my glasses. Like, for instance, I take my glasses off when I'm in here with you because I have to read things that are in front of us.
Uh-huh.
But I can't see what the television over your shoulder says because it's too far away.
You're missing out on just a magnificent handsomeness over here.
Yeah, so now I need to figure out this. I'm thinking about contacts, but I don't think I could do the monovision because I have two eyes.
Well, that's the whole point. And I'm putting my eyes to their maximum benefit. I'm maximizing my ability to see far. I'm maximizing my ability to read fine print. I don't need any kind of reading glasses.
Yeah.
Give me a menu. Give me a salt shaker, and I'll read you all the ingredients.
What about some?
No fights, just insights. Talking politics with respect for all. This is KMOX.
But ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, baby? Ain't that America home of the free? Yeah, little pink houses for you and me.
Little pink houses for you and me. Those could be right here in downtown St. Louis soon, John.
Say.
You'll remember we used to have two jails inside the city of St. Louis. There's one right here at the correction center where people seem to be dying on a regular basis.
Yeah.
There's the other one, which is called the Workhouse up in North City there off of Hall Street. And the mayor closed that, saying that it needed to be closed, and canceled the federal contract that was a revenue generator for the city of St. Louis. And that jail now sits empty. So they're trying to figure out, what should we do with this property?
Yes.
Well, you may have heard that the mayor is proposing that that site be demolished and that they allow little tiny houses
built
there, right, instead of the jail. Your thoughts on this?
Little tiny houses on the jail site. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, well, what a stupid idea. they've already got a building full of tiny houses there. Yeah, they tiny houses to put inmates in, Michael, and that's what they ought to be using that facility for. Now we finally have a prosecutor in this city, and we're finally actually sentencing people to jail. And guess what? We don't have enough jail space. You know what that means?
What?
We have to
ship them away, buddy.
And we have to pay other people to house and incarcerate our inmates, moving them out of their community. I mean, to the extent you're sympathetic to the prison population, you know, why ship them off to Kentucky when you've got a perfectly fine, usable facility here and a facility here that was allowing the city of St. Louis to house prisoners from other places and make money? This is a terrible idea.
Sounds like you're wanting to solve daily issues that a city's supposed to be dealing with rather than dealing with societal issues that have existed since the beginning of time, John.
Yeah.
Don't you understand that local government's now turned into the place where we're going to fix all the problems?
So who is it they're going to put in these? The homeless, right? They're going to put the homeless in the tiny
houses? Veterans, homeless. Hey, look, the tiny house program is great. I love it. I mean, we've built about 100 tiny houses up here and not far from where we're at right now, and it's an alternative to homelessness, which I think makes sense. But why we're closing down a perfectly good jail, canceling federal contracts that were generating us money, a jail that we need the space in,
yes,
so that we can knock it down to potentially build tiny houses, for what purpose? To be able to say, hey, we knocked a jail down and turned it into tiny houses? But so rather than having a bunch of homeless people roaming the streets, we now have criminals roaming the street, but our homeless people live in tiny houses.
I guess are these free for people? You can just come and move in?
Well, it's tiny, so I don't think it costs much. It's like a value meal.
Well, but you still have to build the darn thing. It's going to cost a lot of money to build all of those. And I guess if you're presently living on the street, that you probably don't have an income source.
Yeah.
So they're going to just let people. Now, will they assign a tiny house? Like, you know, Joe over here?
Well, potentially, yeah. And listen, we're swimming in cash right now. So, I mean, the city's swimming in cash. Now, mark my words, John Hancock, we are going to be sitting here in the next year or so talking about all of the money that the city of St. Louis is giving back to the federal government. You know, the ARPA money.
Yeah.
Because they didn't spend it.
Yeah.
And so right now they got the cash. But don't hold your breath, because they're probably going to run out of cash. I wish they put some of that cash on the streets so that we could get some roads that I wouldn't have to replace my tires every time I drive on them.
It's so true. And where is this plan? I guess it has to get approved by the Board of Aldermen. They'll probably be able to get that done.
Well, it's an initial idea that's coming from the mayor. Who knows? The mayor and the Board of Aldermen, they're not singing from the same tune anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that's a progressive-dominated Board of Aldermen. The mayor was elected on progressive values. Now there seems to be a lot of tension going on there. Will be interesting to watch who comes out on top. Speaking of tension, boy, is there bigger tension in the world than what's going on in Gaza and Israel. Of course, we all know about the October 7th attack and then of the response by the Israelis since then. Pressure from the United States was one, supportive of Israel, and then, suddenly some concerns as it relates to the force and the overwhelming force that Israel's using. John, we heard from Chuck Schumer. He said, hey, it's time for us to put in a new government.
Terrible.
It's time for us to look at a ceasefire. Today at the United Nations, the United States, who helped work against a ceasefire resolution less than a month ago, will be the sponsor and will be pushing this through. I think it's a good thing. It's time for us to get this war over with. Your thoughts?
I think it's a reversal of policy, A. I think it's a poor alliance. I mean, that's not a very good friend to Israel. Here we are in front of the UN Security Council, going to propose a ceasefire resolution, which has no effect. It's just a statement. And we're going to vote against Israel. And, you know, where the tension is right now, most of the war has been focused in the immediate area, and a lot of the Palestinians have moved down to Rafah, which is at the border with Egypt. And Israel's next offensive is going to be, they've telegraphed, against Rafah. And true enough, there are a lot of civilians there, a lot of the population there, but there's also a lot of Hamas militants, the terrorists there. And at the end of the day, Israel's got a right to defend itself, a duty to defend its people. They've got the ability to weed out these Hamas terrorists and bring them to eradicate them, basically. And we have been supportive of that policy from day one, from the October 7th attack. And now, by calling for a ceasefire, what that would do, and the ceasefire is going to be coupled with a demand that Hamas release hostages, which they've now had for months and months, and under what must be the most horrific and inhumane conditions imaginable. And here we are. And the United States is the one nation in the world that can stand up with Israel, and we're not doing it in the UN.
Yeah, but how much longer is this supposed to go on? I mean, they literally...
Until it's done.
Yeah, but they've leveled it, John. There's nothing left. Now look, I'm all for getting the bad guys. Let's go get them all. Let's kill them all. But there's millions of civilians, regular people like you and I, who are caught in the middle of all this stuff, who continue to sit on the sidelines. Their country has been decimated. It's been leveled. It's nothing but rubble. That's a consequence of what happened here. I get that. But how much longer does this go on? What is the resolution? Do we just keep bombing them and bombing them and bombing them until all the cockroaches are dead?
Well, you've got to weed Hamas out. And if you've got a network-linked terrorist organization that's right at the border of your country. I mean, we put ourselves in the same position. You've got hundreds of thousands of trained, equipped fighters are being equipped by Iran. And they're at your border. They've executed the single deadliest attack on your country in its history. The most deadly attack against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. You know, you've got to defend yourself, and I think that's the prerogative.
And I'm 1,000,000% there. Yeah. I'm on the side of Israel, but, I mean, I just wonder when this ends, how it ends. And I think that's what the administration's trying to force the conversation happening. At the end of the day, this is the powder keg of the world. This is the Middle East, for goodness sakes.
Well,
fine, you can go ahead and have this type of an action, but there has to be a long-term solution.
Sure.
It just can't be continuing to drop bombs.
But a ceasefire is not going to bring anything to an end, because you're going to then begin to see the hostilities continue their efforts. And, I'm on the side of Israel. Israel is in the right in this conflict. There is no question about that, and they have a right to defend themselves and protect their people.
Well, speaking of crisis, conflicts, and tension, that sounds like the United States Congress, John, and it sounds like the Republican Party. Probably the best friend that Joe Biden has running for president is Republicans. Now they've got a problem with Speaker Johnson. You'll remember that they threw out the previous speaker on one vote with Matt Gaetz. Speaker Johnson's hopefully found some way to maybe keep the government open. As a result, the Freedom Caucus, or what do they even call themselves?
The
MAGA Caucus is now saying they are upset with Mike Johnson. They want to bump him and throw him out. Do they just want Donald Trump himself to come be the Speaker of the United States, Speaker of the House?
I'm not sure what they want. There's a small faction within the Freedom Caucus itself that I think their desire is chaos. I mean, I think that is the objective, is to create as much chaos as possible. And you know their names, Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, there's a handful of these folks. And it only takes a handful of these folks, especially now, to remove a speaker. If you get one member that files an initiative to discharge the speaker, and he or she has one or two Republican allies with them, and all of the Democrats vote to expel the speaker, that's going to happen. And it's the stupid rules that were put in place that Kevin McCarthy negotiated, why he's no longer speaker.
I don't get what's up here. I mean, I get that there is something about the Republican Party that, lighting a firecracker, throwing it into a full room and walking away is entertainment these days for those folks. And that's essentially what they're doing to this speaker. But isn't this going to ultimately harm them? I mean, one of the narratives that the Biden administration is trying to put out there about Donald Trump is, remember the chaos of the Trump years? Heck, you're still living it now.
Yeah. That's inarguable. But if you look at the polls, Donald Trump might be the next president of the United States, Michael.
There's no doubt about that. Hey, he's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. We're going to be with you all the way till 11 o'clock. We'll be joined by Amy and Chris here in a little bit. You can see us Sunday mornings at 8:30 on Fox 2 in St. Louis. It's Hancock, Kelly, you right here on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Happy Friday, St. Louis. It is the boys, Hancock and Kelly. We'll take you all the way to 11 o'clock. Chris and Amy are going to come in studio us here in a little bit. Hey, you're all spun up over something. You get worried about the fact that we're trying to cut global gases that are warming the planet?
Yeah, good for us.
That's good.
Our Environmental Protection Agency yesterday has issued...
do you know who started the EPA?
Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon.
1973.
Milhouse.
They issued a revised regulation yesterday that by the year 2032, 56% of new vehicle sales must be electric vehicles. And another 13% have to be plug-in hybrids.
Hey, now.
So basically, they're dictating what kind of car American consumers can purchase.
So, wait a minute. Didn't they dictate that we had to have seatbelts and airbags?
Well, not
didn't
exactly.
They dictate the height of a bumper from the ground? Didn't they dictate? I mean, come on, John. We've been dictating a lot as it relates to automobiles,
but
probably more than any other industry out there.
They've never eliminated options for consumers like this. So you're forcing people to purchase electric vehicles because if you want, a gas car, you're going to have to pay more for it, I would assume. It's the government injecting itself into the marketplace.
But the government is injecting itself into our libraries. It's injecting itself into our doctor's offices. It's always been involved in industry, particularly the auto industry. Look, I don't understand what the hatred for these electric vehicles.
I don't hate them.
We incentivize
I'm
them to work.
Them.
And the market's already going that way anyway.
Not nearly like this. And so if you look at the sales of electric car vehicles, they are increasing. There's no question about that, but they're not increasing at a rate that's going to get us to 2/3 of all cars being either electric or hybrid within 8 years, which is what this rule requires. It's going to be challenged in court. I hope the car companies will prevail. And look, electric vehicles, if the idea is we're going to save the planet by getting rid of, gas guzzling automobiles that are belching out carbon, and we're going to somehow save the planet, what we're doing also is mandating that these lithium infused batteries
Now you're worried about the environment when it comes to lithium, but with lithium. I mean, do you understand how you sit there and say, this is ridiculous that we're doing all
ridiculous.
This environmental stuff? Hey, how about the environmental stuff over here, Kelly? We need to talk about this.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
very
that's
concerned.
Not ridiculous. It's showing that the government is trying to solve a problem and they're creating another problem and they're mandating and they're getting in the way of the marketplace. Let consumers decide. Increasingly, consumers are opting for electric vehicles. Great. I'm all for that.
But the government and the EPA, John, has said, hey, look, you can no longer have 12 miles per hour gallons. You've got to be at 20. And then they moved it to 30. And now they're getting it up there. This is continuing to move the needle away from the consumption of fossil fuels. Why isn't that great? Being less dependent on the Arab countries that are down there with all this money, our money, by the way, if we went to something more like electric. And it also happens to do something that will be positive for your grandchildren.
I don't know if it's a net positive at all. And we still don't know how we're going to dispose of these batteries. To get the lithium, the content into these electric car batteries that you're mining all over the world and in some of the most abusive countries imaginable to pull this stuff out.
It sounds like you're describing fossil fuels. I mean, that's what you're describing. The most abusive countries ever? Name more abusive countries than treat women the way they do in Saudi Arabia and down there in the Middle East.
I'm talking about slave labor. I'm talking
exactly.
I'm talking about mining and strip mining and laying the planet. I mean, you're creating...
Some of the biggest lithium deposits are right here in the Midwest.
Buddy, you cannot have this volume of electric vehicles without turning to a lot of adversary nations to get the lithium and the other materials.
I can get there where you say, look, I just think you ought to be able to buy whatever you want,
yes.
Kelly. But when you try to make it an environmental argument, no. When you try to make it a humanitarian or a human rights issue, no. Because when you're wearing that's like the guy who's sitting there saying, listen, We ought not be burning down buildings while you're over lighting a fire. I mean, come on. Go with me on this. What I'm suggesting to you is you're whatabouting when the very nature of what we're currently doing is bad.
I'm simply pointing out that the electric car is not an environmental panacea. Listen, and the government is mandating the purchase of them. And here's another thing. Let me throw this one
out. And another thing, he says.
These electric cars won't probably affect us much in St. Louis, but where you've got extreme weather situations, they don't perform as well. You get extreme cold, you can't start the darn thing. And you got to tell the people in Duluth and Buffalo that
I would like to take this tape. And everywhere you're using fossil fuels and the big arm of government, I want to do it as it relates to doctors and healthcare and women's healthcare.
It's a different issue.
No, I understand it's a different issue. But you use this liberty, stay out of our stuff argument here. But when it comes to a woman, no, we're not going to do that.
Because there's also a child involved in the issue of abortion.
In your eyes, I think it's a collection of cells.
Okay, whatever.
But I mean, here's the, or when you sit there and you're going to give me an environmental lecture.
Yes.
As if, lithium is killing the world. No, right now what's killing the world is what we're putting out of our engines that's going up and causing global warming.
Not going to solve this problem. You're not going to solve this problem.
There it
with
is.
A government mandate.
Declaration right there from the world's smartest man. John Hancock has said that's not going to solve the problem, therefore we're not going to do it. What about all these scientists that are saying that that's what we're supposed to do? We need to get all of this carbon out of our atmosphere and quit putting more into it.
Because most of the world is ignoring that dictum. And
yeah, but do you know who is the largest consumer of car?
The United States of America.
Right. So if we make our little difference, how about that? And by the way, when we shift markets to electric vehicles, guess what? The rest of the world follows. You talk about American exceptionalism. You used to be a party that wanted American exceptionalism, those of us to lead the world. If America does this, it's going to happen. In the past, it was California. The state of California had raised up the miles per hour of gallon consumption.
How's that economy
and the rest
working?
Of the country, it's roaring. It's the fifth largest economy on the planet. It's a state. California is booming, dude.
Booming?
Booming.
Booming?
Booming.
Tell me that in San Francisco. San Francisco is not booming.
Come on, John. It's the fifth largest economy on the planet is the state of California, and it's working. They've been able to shift thinking and behaviors with this type of actions. I think this is a positive step in the right direction.
We're never going to get there. And I don't think the market will abide by this regulation. I don't know that the Supreme Court, by ultimately, if a case gets there, is going to say that the government has this authority what they're doing.
This Supreme Court is going to do whatever, the Republicans want.
And I am all for consumers buying electric vehicles. If you want an electric vehicle, go out and get one and drive that sucker 300 miles and then charge it for 8 hours.
Hey, let's take our hats off for a second. I've shifted to electric
vehicle. I know you
vehicle.
Have.
I love it.
Yeah, you love it.
And I got to tell you, I don't understand how all the haters on these electric vehicles, fine, be a hater. They're awesome.
No,
this
I get
car
it.
Is 1,000 times better than any gas car I've ever driven.
Yeah.
It's smooth. It's easy. There's none of the nonsense. I never have to go to one of these gas stations and fill up. Put aside the politics of it. I don't understand why y'all aren't doing it. It's faster. It's quicker. It goes there. You can charge it at home. You don't ever have to go and deal with the public at a gas station anymore. The only liquid you have to put in your car is the blue juice. Come on, dude. It's changing. You need to get in on this.
No. I get the appeal of them. Now, I don't think you'd want to drive it to California from here. But
you could.
Yeah.
You could. But, you could used to have to ride your horse. And guess what? Times have changed and evolved. And then we came up with a gas car. The electric car is going to get you to California soon.
Well, the government's going to tell you what kind of car to buy, folks. So I hope you're happy
about that. Well, and it's going to tell you what you have to do with your own reproductive system as well. And that's John
Hancock.
Different
issue.
Same thing, though. The government getting involved there. I just love it when we have the audacity of the government's getting involved in this. By the way, let's talk books.
What?
You just the Republican mantra about how government's so intrusive when you are the most intrusive with government. We have a legislature down in Jefferson City that they're trying to inject government into every aspect of our lives so that we all practice their Christian nonsense.
And we don't like government involved in every aspect of our lives, do we, Michael? No.
I don't.
Well, and I don't like it here. And when we come back, the government's going to get involved and go after your Apple iPhone. We'll see what that's all about. That's next right here on KMOX.
Now, back to Hancock and Kelly. Sponsored by Insperity. HR that makes a difference. On News Radio 1120, KMOX.
I think we could probably have a subscription service for the during the commercials.
Yeah.
The conversation and the things we talk about.
Yes.
People could pay like a separate fee to hear what we might think on a particular issue. We got a lot coming to you this morning. We're going to talk about the iPhone and Apple, who's under antitrust scrutiny by the federal government. Shohei Ohtani, I can't wait to get your opinion on this. As it relates to betting, betting seems to have taken over sports. And now Major League Baseball seems to have found itself right in the middle of a betting fight.
Yeah, controversy out there.
It's, yeah, with its biggest star.
Really interesting. That's going to be an interesting discussion. That's coming up after the news.
And then
at 9:30.
We're going to reminisce about the World's Fair.
Yes,
John.
New book.
But you may remember about 120 years ago when St. Louis did that.
Almost exactly.
We still celebrate it regularly, like it was yesterday.
Well, it was a big deal.
So
and, there's a new book out about it. We're going to talk about it.
The Justice Department on Thursday announced a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Apple. And ultimately what they're saying is that the suit takes aim at how Apple allegedly molds its technology and business relationships to extract more money from consumers, developers, content creators, artists, publishers, small business merchants, and others. Sounds to me like they're just doing business. I mean, look, I understand the role of antitrust and monopolies. But when you create a mousetrap, isn't your mousetrap to have the best mousetrap so that you collect most of the mice? I got to drop this analogy. But, I mean, isn't that what a business is supposed to be doing? Apple's trying to sell a product that's going to bring more and more people into it.
I'm a little puzzled by this as well.
Yeah.
Because when you think of a monopoly, you think about somebody that is so cornered in industry and maybe they've vertically integrated, and certainly Apple has vertically integrated, but to the exclusion of competition. Well, there's competition out there. Apple's in the marketplace.
Google.
And consumers have choices about what kind of devices they want to purchase. And to your point, is Apple being penalized here because they've done it better?
But there are a couple of things they've done. So Apple launched its own Apple Pay, which is essentially its own credit card system.
Right.
And they've made it more difficult for regular American Express and other pay forms to be on your phone. I actually get that. I can see how the government could say, hey, wait a minute. No, you've got to allow this to be open so that people can choose how they want to pay. But the fact that you created apps and you want people to maybe only go through the Apple iStore, I think it's kind of feeding that narrative of, hey, we've created a good product. We're going to continue to supplement, augment the stuff around that product. But, you know, I didn't really necessarily understand the whole Microsoft antitrust, John, and they seem to have come out of it just fine.
Yeah, and you know, it probably is true that Apple customers are paying more because of the uniqueness of that technology. There's in the stuff I've read anyway, the margins that the company is getting on its iPhone far surpass the margins of any of their competitors. And once they've got the consumer locked in to that product, that consumer's locked into a whole host of other things that go along with it. So that's the basis, I think, of the government's suit. But I just think they're going to have a difficult time proving that a monopoly exists in this industry. And that's ultimately what the courts are going to decide.
And your phone, whether it be a Google phone or an Apple phone, it's become your everything. I mean, it's more important than your wallet. It's more important than your transportation in many instances. And you and I do our entire business on our phone. So maybe there is a role for the government to make sure that we're not being taken advantage of. But I don't know. I see the stock is sinking on Apple this morning, and it's sinking because there are people are saying, oh, they've created an antitrust. Well, I got to tell you what, if you got a good racket, why would you move away from it?
Yeah, and you know, the part of the government's complaint here is that Apple is stifling innovation. Well, I just disagree with that. I mean, if you look at how this industry has evolved in really 25 years, it's staggering.
Yeah, we went from having a big block that we would carry around now to this little thing I can touch and rearrange satellites with.
There's more technology in your cell phone today than there was on the Apollo spacecraft that landed on the moon.
Wow.
And, you know, so to make an argument that this is stifling innovation, I think, is just facially wrong. And I don't know that the government's going to be able to prove that.
So here's something I learned related to phones earlier this week. I wanted to ask you about it.
All right.
I know some people who are older, in their 60s or so, and their kids are still on their cell phone plan. Now, these are grown individuals that are 30 years old, having their own families. And by the way, I've done a little survey in my own life. This is not unique. When in the world did the responsibility of paying for the cell phone go to the person who's been around the longest? And it's not, I mean, it's, this is happening everywhere. Do you have any dependents still on your cell phone, Bill?
I'm not here to talk about the past, Michael.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But, you know, because it's really a first-generation problem, right?
Right.
Because our kids are the first generation that have been on a cell phone plan.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have become reasonably functioning adults.
Yeah.
So I'm not shocked that there's not a whole lot of this going on out there.
This particular group that I ran into, I mean, this is the one family that they were like, the kids are still on the cell phone plan. And the kids have literally three children, grown adults. They're out running their own businesses, et cetera, and they're still on their parents' cell phone bill. Now, how does that work? I don't know. I would feel emasculated if I was still on my mom's cell phone. By the way, I wonder if my mom would put me on her cell phone bill.
Well, now a lot of people are putting their older parents on their cell phone plans as well. So you kind of got it coming from both sides.
But I think you and I, we're getting crunched here because we just happened to be at that age where we had to get our own cell phone.
We did.
And now that everybody that's coming along after us gets to get on our cell phone plan because it's normal. That's what everybody does.
How old are kids now when they're getting their first phone? Are we talking 10? Are we talking 13?
I think it's kind of like pierced ears and that kind of stuff. I think different families have different rules. You see the little kids in restaurants and stuff playing with iPads and cell phones. I don't know if that's their parents, but I'm not a person who has a kid. I would probably guess like 7th, 8th grade. What are you, like 12, 13 years old?
Something like that.
Because it really is the social network of life, too. It's kind of taken over in many aspects.
Yeah, I don't envy younger parents coming up these days within this world of social media and setting guidelines and boundaries for their kids. You know, it just wasn't an issue. I mean, later on, you know, when my kids were in their teens, a lot of this stuff was just starting. And it was less of an issue. Now, it's pervasive and you can't get away from it.
So I this is an interesting observation. I was out of town this week, and I was in an airport. Uh-huh. And I'm old enough to remember when you would go to the airport to look at people. You know what I mean? It was a great place to do people watching.
Yeah.
Yesterday when I was in the airport, I'm walking through there, everybody.
Everybody,
including the pilots.
Right.
Everybody was on their phone. You could have walked in there and stolen people's bags.
That's a comforting feeling. The pilot's got his head buried in
the
cell phone.
Well, he wasn't flying the plane. Right. He was waiting to go on a plane like the rest of us.
All right, when we come back, Shohei Ohtani is in the news, and we're going to break down what we think and what we know. That's next right here on KMOX.
It is getting close to decision time for the Cardinals and their roster. This is Tom Ackerman in Jupiter, Florida. Listen for my spring training reports, as only we can bring them to you from the T.R. Hughes broadcast location in Jupiter. On the Voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You better count your money when you're sitting.
What a great tune.
Tremendous tune. Kenny Rogers.
I wonder how much money he made off of this song alone.
Oh, he did well. And they made movies, you know, about the gambler.
Is he in the movies?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What happened to those great movies with, like, Neil Diamond and, you know, those
Elvis.
Types of Elvis were in movies?
Elvis was in a Western, I didn't realize.
In a Western?
Yes.
I thought he was always in war movies.
No, he was in a Western. I saw, you know, I watch a lot of Westerns over at the house now.
Yeah. When you're hanging out with your father-in-law?
Yeah.
You guys are into
it? I'm into it.
You ever get into Gunsmoke?
I'm into it. Fester's out there.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of bonanza going on.
Have you thought about, you know, giving me a little nickname? How you doing there, Big Tex?
I already gave you a nickname.
What is it?
The Irish Assassin.
Hey, now.
That's your snooker nickname.
Yeah, coming in with your little your little costume on. You're going to wear your little hat and boots and walk in here one day and
I've got it. I can do the cowboy.
How about the jeans that cowboy guys wear? They wear those jeans that they press, you know, like they can almost stand up on their own. What are they called? Wranglers, I guess, you know, jeans. But they
there's a lot of jeans out there.
Know. They take them to the like cleaners and have them starch them.
Well, yeah, that's how you.
It's
you
know, weird
when you're no. It's
I don't get starch on anything. You get starch in your clothes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Because I like it.
To hold it?
Yeah, and it, you don't got a bunch of wrinkles. Look how wrinkle free this shirt is I'm wearing today.
Huh.
Why? Because it's got starch in it.
The t-shirt.
Medium starch. So I mean, you know, there you have it.
I'll bet you it'll have wrinkles by the end of the day.
Well, you never bet on things. You know, we have this scandal brewing in the Major League Baseball, and it came out a couple days ago. I just find this interesting.
I mainly wanted to do this topic just to hear him pronounce all these names.
So Shohei Ohtani, who is the most famous baseball player and I think the greatest remunerated baseball player in the world, has an interpreter, has had since 2018 when he started his big league career with the Los Angeles
Angels. What's that guy's name?
His name is Ippe Mizuhara. Mizuhara.
Excuse me. That's
I misread
right.
the R there.
Yeah.
It's M-I-Z.
Z-O-U.
Yes, and that's the interpreter. And they're very good friends, very close friends.
Yeah.
So close, in fact, that Ippe, during the baseball strike, was employed by the Angels, and not the strike, the lockout, when the owners locked out the players. And because he was employed by the team, he couldn't communicate with his buddy Shohei Ohtani during that lockout.
What'd he do to keep himself busy?
So he resigned from the Angels so that he could continue
hanging
out.
Oh, hang with his friend.
Yeah, because they're buddies.
Yeah.
So it turns out that $4 million in gambling debts of some sort were paid off by Shohei Ohtani, or Shohei Ohtani's money, to a bookie who is currently under federal investigation for illegal gambling activities.
Ruh-roh.
That's not good. And so they had a clubhouse meeting the other day with the Dodgers, where Ippe now works, as does Shohei Ohtani. And in the clubhouse meeting, Ippe apologizes that he's got a gambling problem, obviously, and that his good friend Shohei had paid off his $4 million gambling debt.
As one does.
And he apologized to the team. Everybody said, wow, that's really bad. He gets fired then by the team. And within hours of that clubhouse meeting, Shohei Ohtani's attorneys released a statement saying, no. Ippe stole the money. Ippe took the money and paid off the bookie.
$4.5 million steal. $4.5 million.
I think it was nobody just four.
Okay,
it was just four.
All right, $4 million.
Yeah,
I mean that's not like, $20 is missing from my wallet. It's $4 million.
So in order for Ippe to have quote stolen the money, he would have had to have access to Shohei's, accounts.
And you have to imagine that a guy like Shohei, who's worth, probably $500 million right now.
He's doing well.
I don't think he's sitting at home writing his own little checks. He's probably got accountants and business people who do stuff for him.
Yeah.
So for $4 million to leave Shohei's account, it's not as simple as going over to somebody's house and being like, hey, give me a couple bucks.
Right.
Oh, here's $4 million. No. There had to have been a process
money's
here.
Money's getting wired to this bookie, and the feds are onto it. So Ippe's been fired. Shohei, I'm sure Major League Baseball's got an investigation underway. And here's the dilemma with baseball. I mean, there's a very rich, ugly history of gambling in baseball.
Pete Rose is not in the Hall of Fame over gambling.
He's banished from baseball.
The Black Sox stole the World Series over gambling.
They gave it away.
Yeah.
They gave it to the Cincinnati Reds in 1919. And there was a bunch of those players, among them Shoeless Joe Jackson, who may have been the best player in the game at that time in 1919.
Still not in the Hall of Fame.
No. And been banished from baseball. In fact, he was working at a liquor store down south.
Is that right?
Yeah. And Ty Cobb walked in and they recognized each other. Fun little. But anyway, I digress.
So, but now we have arguably the biggest star in professional sports.
Right.
Definitely the biggest star in baseball, and maybe going down as one of the best baseball players of all time, if not the best.
So there's three possibilities here. One is that Ippe's original story is accurate, that his buddy, and I think this is the most likely, that Ipe ran up some debts. He fessed up to Shohei, and Shohei took care of it.
Hey, here you go.
All right. That's a possibility. Second possibility is that Ipe had some way or another had access to Shohei's money and stole it, which is what Shohei's lawyers are claiming.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either. Third possibility is that Shohei himself
may be involved in the whole deal.
Yes.
Eey.
And so
can't help but think it.
And it's, so there's nothing illegal per se about Shohei paying off his buddy's debts, but baseball would have a really hard time with that, especially if they're gambling on
what's
on baseball.
Different here though, John, is past things as it related to Pete Rose and that stuff. That was Major League Baseball investigations.
Right.
This is the FBI.
Well, you got
the
both,
feds.
Right.
Are we're going to find out the real story?
I think that's probably right.
And I'm sure baseball would like this to be clean because this is their biggest star. Yeah, and by the way, not only their biggest star in the United States, but more importantly, their biggest star around the world.
Yeah, no question. Another complicating factor here is that both the Los Angeles Angels and the Los Angeles Dodgers happen to be in the state of California.
Right.
That does not have legalized sports betting.
Ruh-roh.
So now you've got potential state criminal violations. This is one to keep an eye on, folks. We're going to get to the bottom of it. We also are going to get to the bottom of a brand new book that's coming out early next month. It's called Prelude to a Century, the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair. Its author, Patrick Murphy, joins us after this on KMOX.
Stay connected with the heartbeat of St. Louis. KMOX News, bringing you the stories that matter most.
John, did you know that in 1904, the eyes of the world were on St. Louis?
They were indeed, Michael.
We had the World's Fair.
We did.
And, you know, I've spent a lot of time walking through Forest Park, going into the History Museum, and they've got some cool photos, etc., of what the World's Fair looked like. Holy cow, ladies and gentlemen, we have the quintessential book that blows it all away. You're going to see photos that have never shown up before as it relates to the 1904
Brand
World's Fair.
Brand spanking new, Prelude to a Century, the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, just out, and it's everywhere. Its author, Patrick Murphy, is our guest. You know Patrick Murphy for many years at the PBS station in St. Louis, Channel 9. Patrick, this book is phenomenal. I like the way you tell the story of the fair in short vignettes, and there's so many of them.
Yeah, there's so many stories. There are about 90 little vignettes here, and each one of them shows a slightly different aspect of the fair. And it's easy to read. I mean, you can put it by your bedside or on your coffee table and pick it up and, you know, read it and look at the pictures. You're right. A lot of undigitized pictures from the Missouri Historical Society and the public library that have never been seen before are in the book.
Yeah, and Patrick, you have the photos of all the buildings that surrounded the Grand Basin. When you see the Grand Basin now and we see St. Louis, etc., you think, wow, there used to be almost like a city built around that, right?
It was. They called it the Ivory City. And imagine 1904 and what St. Louis was. It was the fourth biggest city in the country back then, but it was still kind of a mess. You know, a lot of packed neighborhoods and not a lot of electricity. And it was, you know, kind of a dirty, polluted city. And they'd go to the fair and they'd see this thing like Oz or Olympus, this gigantic ivory city with these giant palaces. And if you take your imagination now and you go to the bottom of the basin or the top of Art Hill in front of the Art Museum and look with your imagination, you can actually see those palaces now.
Yeah.
You know, they were just magnificent. Some of those palaces were as big as 20 acres and had 100 miles of aisles in them.
And the politics of even citing this in St. Louis were interesting back then. It was not a slam dunk that
Chicago
the fair was going to be.
Chicago got the 1893.
Yeah, they got
fair,
the 93.
We were ticked.
Yeah, and of course, St. Louis was finally selected to host the 2003 World's Fair.
Yeah,
but didn't quite come off at that time.
It was going to be the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, but there was a lot of work to do. You know, building a giant ivory city takes a lot of time, and getting the world to come to it. So they just kind of quietly said, 1904. We'll do it in 1904.
Yeah, and
good enough.
200,000 people the first day.
Yeah, it was just amazing. And 20 million people over a period of 8 months. So, I mean, the eyes of the world were really on St. Louis.
Well, there's got to be one thing. I mean, we all know about the World's Fair, right? Because we've grown up in St. Louis. We know about ice cream and all the other stuff and the stories. Was there one story or nugget that you learned making this book that just was shocking and mind-blowing to you?
I was amazed Yeah, lots. Lots? Lots. And every one of these stories has something in.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed by the sheer size of it. This was bigger than every World's Fair prior to that put together. It was 1,600 acres. The Chicago one was like half of that. It wasn't just Forest Park. It was also the other side of Skinker, Washington U, all the way up to Clayton Road. But in 1904, Forest Park was basically, it was a wilderness, the western part of it. They had to completely put in sewer lines and electric lines and build the palaces. And I was amazed because I wonder today if we could do that. Would we be capable of doing that?
Yeah.
Would we be capable of even uniting around a vision like
that?
Well,
we don't pave roads well.
No.
We don't. I would be remiss. I got to point out a couple of key dates. On April the 11th at the Missouri History Museum, the book launched. Now, it's available now, but the official launch is going to be Thursday, April the 11th. That is open to the public, I assume.
It is. It is. Please come. And signing books.
And the author, Patrick Murphy, will be signing books on Saturday, April 13th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Webster Books in Webster Groves. And then again the next day, Sunday, April 14th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Main Street Books in St. Charles. You can get his autograph. Folks, this is a really attractive book. You're going to learn a lot of things. And you've got a vignette about one of my favorite people who crossed through the paths of the fair, Scott Joplin.
Oh, yeah, Scott Joplin. Yeah. You know, he made this famous piece of music called The Cascades.
Yes.
But actually, you know, the situation at the fair, it was not officially segregated, but it might as well have been. So Scott Joplin didn't want to play with the other African-American players on the pike. He thought this was classical music that deserved to be played at Festival Hall. And so he didn't actually come to the fair.
Yeah.
But his music made the fair really popular. Oh, there was all kinds of crazy music, all kinds of Tin Pan Alley stuff.
Sousa's orchestra was at the fair.
He opened it up. John Philip Sousa was there a lot. And there was a lot of Tin Pan Alley stuff, like Do the Hoochie Coochie.
Yeah.
You know?
Were there places that countries' delegations wound up taking over to build houses and to host their stuff?
Yeah. In fact, a lot of time was spent going to Europe and getting all of these countries to take St. Louis, of all places, seriously. And they all built other palaces and exhibits and things. If you were like from a country in Europe, you got a big palace. If you were from like the Philippines, you got a reservation at a bunch of little huts and were basically sort of on display,
yeah,
you know, for the tourists. But yeah, the number of countries, it was, you know, really well represented. I mean, better than any other fair that had ever been done before. And I think as St. Louisans, we're not used to saying, you know, we were better than everybody. You know, we were at the top of the heap, you know, back then. Because now we spend a lot of time apologizing.
Yeah.
But if we did it back then, maybe we'd do it again.
And the zoo that we have there today was put in for the World's Fair?
It started with the big bird cage, and they didn't know what to do with the bird cage after the fair was over. And it was going to go back to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and a bunch of business people here said, let's keep it. You know, maybe we could even start a little zoo around it.
What's your personal website so people can see all the signing dates you have coming up?
Well, patrickmurphyauthor.com. You can order a book there, and we try to keep it up to date. Yeah.
The book is called Prelude to a Century, the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair. Author Patrick Murphy has been kind enough to join us. That's April the 11th for the launch at the History Museum, April 13th at Webster Books from 1 to 3. That's a Saturday. Sunday, April 14th from 1 to 3 at Main Street Books in St. Charles to get that sucker signed by the author. Patrick, thank you so much. James O'Sullivan working the board, Frank Ladd producing, Michael Kelly. We'll stick around with Amy and Chris next on KMOX.